Chapter 3, Part 2.
D.B., if I may say that in the beginning it was a simple mistake, and thought made an image of pleasure, and it seemed to become very important, precious, and was unable to give it up.
K. Yes, why doesn't it?
Sir, if I give up pleasure, if thought gives up pleasure, what is there left?
D.B.
It can't seem to return to the state in the beginning when there was nothing.
K.
Ah, that is the pristine state.
D.B.
It is unable to return to that state. Well, I think what happens is that when thought thinks of giving up pleasure, which has become very precious, then the mere thought of that is painful.
K. Yes, giving up is painful.
D.B. And therefore thought runs away from that.
K. Yes, so it clings to pleasure.
D.B. It does not wish to face the pain.
K. Until there is a better reward for pleasure, which will be a better pleasure.
D.B. That's no change.
K. Of course.
D.B. But thought seems to have fallen into a trap which it has made because it has innocently remembered pleasure, and then gradually made it important. And then it has become too painful to give it up, because any change from the immediate removal of pleasure is very painful.
K. Because it has nothing else then afterwards. Then it is frightened, so it clings to something which it knows.
D.B. Which it knows, and which is very precious to it.
K. But it doesn't know that it is going to breed fear.
D.B. Even when it knows, it still clings.
K. But it would much rather run away from fear, hoping the pleasure will continue.
D.B. Eventually, it starts to become irrational because it creates pressures which make the brain irrational and unable to get this straight.
K. Yes, we started off, didn't we, with, is there an action in which there is no motive, no cause? The self doesn't enter into it at all.
Of course there is.
There is when the self is not, which means no identifying process takes place. There is the perceiving of a beautiful lake, with all the color and the glory and the beauty of it. That's enough. Not the cultivating of memory, which is developed through the identification process.
D.B., this raises the question, how are we going to stop this identification?
K. I don't think there is a how.
You see, that means meditation, control, practice, 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 and that way makes the mind mechanical, dull, forgive me, and literally incapable of receiving anything new.
D.B.
I think that ordinarily we are identified with our language, and therefore it is driving us. But if we are free of identification.
K. That's right, sir. It is extraordinary how language has made us.
I am a communist.
D.B. That's an identification.
K. That's it.
D.B. But do you think that language is the major source of identification?
K. One of them.
D.B. One of the big ones.
K. Yes.
Questioner. What do you mean by identify?
Krishnamurti,
I love you. I have identified myself with you. Or I have hurt her, and you identify yourself with her, and get angry with me.
See what has happened? I have said something to her which is harmful and unpleasant.
You are her friend. You identify yourself with her, and get angry with me.
So that is part of the self-centered activity, isn't it?
Are you sure?
I like you. I am very fond of you.
What does that mean?
I like your looks.
You are a good companion, and so on.
It means what?
Q.
It means you are a better companion than other people, and so I like being with you.
K. Go a little deeper. What does it mean?
Q.
You keep that person to yourself and exclude others.
K. That is part of it, but go further.
Q. It is pleasing to be with that person.
K. It is pleasing to be with that person.
And it is not pleasing with another person. So my relationship with you is based on my pleasure. If I don't like you, I say, I'll be off. My pleasure is my concern, as is my hurt, my anger. So self-concern isn't just thinking about myself and identifying with this or that possession, person, or book. Is that what you do all day? There is the peripheral occupation. And also, I am comparing myself with you. That is going on all the time, but from a center.
Q. You read about the refugees in India, and you haven't a personal relationship with them, but you do identify with them.
K. Why do I identify myself with those people who have been killed and chased out of East Pakistan? I watched them the other day on television. This is happening everywhere, not only in Pakistan. It is appalling. Now, you say you identify yourself with all those refugees. What do you feel?
Q. Sympathy.
K. Go on, explore it, unravel it.
Q. 1. Anger against the people who caused this.
Q. 2. Frustration because you can't do anything about it.
K. You get angry with the people who do these things, who kill the young men and chase out old women and children. Is that what you do? You identify with this and reject that. What is the structure, the analysis of this identification?
Q. It is dualistic.
K. Move on.
Q. You don't feel secure.
K. Through identification, you feel that you could do something.
Q. Even by taking one side, you feel that you have a certain chance to do something.
K. I am anti-Catholic. I identify myself with a group who are anti-clerical. Identifying myself with those, I feel I can do something. But go further. It is still me doing something about it. It is still the occupation with myself. I have identified myself with what I consider greater, India, communism, Catholicism, and so on. My family, my God, my belief, my house. You have hurt me. You follow? What is the reason for this identification?
Q. I separate myself from the rest of the world, and in identifying with something bigger, that something becomes my ally.
K. Yes, but why do you do this?
I identify myself with you because I like you. I don't identify myself with him because I don't like him. And I identify myself with my family, with my country, with my God, with my belief. Now, why do I identify with anything at all? I don't say it is right or wrong. What is behind this identification?
Q. Inward confusion.
K. Is it?
Q. You are afraid.
K. Push further.
Q. The confusion is caused by the identification.
K. Is it?
I am questioning you, and you must question me, too. Don't accept what I am saying. Inquire.
This whole process of identification, why does it happen? And if I don't identify myself with you or with something, I feel frustrated.
Are you sure?
Q. 1. I don't know.
Q. 2. You feel unfulfilled, empty.
K. Go on. I feel sad, frustrated, not fulfilled, insufficient, empty. Now I want to know why I identify myself with a group, with a community, with feelings, ideas, ideals, heroes, and all the rest of it. Why?
Q. I think it is in order to have security.
K. Yes, but what do you mean by that word, security?
Q. Alone, I am weak.
K. Is it because you cannot stand alone?
Q.
It is because you are afraid to stand alone.
K. You are frightened of being alone, so therefore you identify?
Q. Not always.
K. But it is the core, the root of it. Why do I want to identify myself?
Because then I feel safe. I have pleasant memories of people and places, so I identify myself with that.
I see in identification I am much more secure, right?
Q. I don't know if you want to talk about this particular aspect, but if I see the killing in Vietnam is wrong, and there is a group of anti-war demonstrators in Washington, then I go and join them.
K. Now, wait a minute. There is an anti-war group, and I join them. I identify myself with them because in identifying with a group of people who are doing something about it, I am also doing something about it. By myself, I cannot do anything. But belonging to a group of people who demonstrate, who write articles and say it is terrible, I am actively taking part in stopping the war. That is the identification. We are not seeking the results of that identification, whether it is good or bad. But why does the human mind want to identify itself with something? The identification takes place because you feel, here I am secure. So is the reason you identify because you are insecure? Is that it? Insecurity means fear, uncertainty, not to know what to think, to be confused. So you need protection. It is good to have protection. Is that the reason why you identify? What is the next step? In myself, I am uncertain, unclear, confused, frightened, and insufficient. Therefore, I identify myself with a belief. Now what happens?
Q. I find I am still insecure.
K. No, I have identified myself with certain ideologies. What happens then?
Q. You try to make that your security.
K. I have given various reasons for this identification because it is rational, it is workable, all the rest of it. Now, what happens when I have identified myself with it?
Q. You have a conflict.
K. Look what happens. I have identified myself with an ideology, with a group of people or a person. It is part of me. I must protect that, mustn't I? Therefore, if it is threatened, I am lost. I am back again to my insecurity.
So what takes place?
I am angry with anybody who attacks or doubts it.
Then, what is the actual thing that takes place?
Q. Conflict.
K. Look, I have identified myself with an ideology. I must protect it because it is my security, and I resist anybody who threatens that, in the sense of having a contradictory ideology. So where I have identified myself with an ideology, there must be resistance. I build a wall round what I have identified myself with. Where there is a wall, it must create division. Then there is conflict. I don't know if you see all this. Now, what is the next step? Go on.
Q. 1. What is the difference between identification and cooperation?
Q. 2. It seems there has to be more understanding of cooperation.
K.
You know what it means to cooperate, to work together. Can there be cooperation when there is identification? Do you know what we mean by identification? We have examined the anatomy of it. Cooperation means to work together. Can I work with you if I have identified myself with an ideology, and you are identified with another ideology?
Obviously not.
Q. But people have to work together.
K. Is that cooperation?
Q. No.
K.
See what is involved. Because of our identification with an ideology, we work together. You protect it, and I protect it. It is our security, in the name of God, in the name of beauty, in the name of anything. We think that is cooperation. Now, what takes place? Can there be cooperation when there is identification with a group? Q. No, because there is division. I find myself in conflict with members of the group because I keep identifying with them. K. Look what is happening. You and I have identified ourselves with that ideology. Our interpretation of that ideology may be Q. Different. K. Of course, if you vary in the interpretation of that ideology, you are deviating. Therefore, we are in conflict. Therefore, we must both of us agree about that ideology completely. Is that possible? Q. That is exactly what happens with a school. Instead of an ideology, you identify with a school, and each person has his own concept. K. Yes. Quite right. Why? Q. I sense that sometimes there is conflict here for just the reason you were giving when talking about an ideology. If you and I identify with the school, we think we are cooperating, but there isn't that spirit. K. Therefore, I am asking, can there be cooperation when there is identification? Q. No. K. Do you know what you are saying? Laughter. That is how everything in this world is working. Is that the truth, that where there is identification, there can be no cooperation? It is a marvelous thing to discover the truth of this, not your opinion or my opinion, but the truth, the validity of it. Therefore, we have to find out what we mean by cooperation. You see, there can be no cooperation when there is identification with an idea, with a leader, with a group, and so on. Then what is cooperation in which there is no identification? Q. Acting in response to the situation itself. K. I am not saying you are not right, but can we work together when you and I think differently? When you are concerned with yourself, and I am concerned with myself. And one of the reasons is that knowing we cannot cooperate when we are thinking of ourselves, we try to identify ourselves with an ideology, hoping thereby to bring about cooperation. But if you don't identify, what is cooperation? Here we are at Brockwood in a school. We see there cannot be cooperation when there is identification with the school, with an idea, with a program, with a particular policy of this and that. And also we see that identification is the cause of all division. Then what is cooperation? To work together, not about something? Do you see the difference? So before you do something together, what is the spirit of cooperation? The feeling, the inwardness of it. What is that feeling? Q. Understanding, being completely open to it. K. Go a little deeper. We said identification is not cooperation. Are you quite sure on that point? And are you quite clear that cooperation cannot exist when each of us is concerned with himself? But you are concerned with yourself. Therefore, you have no spirit of cooperation. You only cooperate when it pleases you. So what does it mean to cooperate? We are not playing parlor games. What does it mean to cooperate when there is no me? Otherwise, you can't cooperate. I may try to cooperate round an idea, but there is always the me. Questioner. You say that through identification we bring about separation, division. Your way of life appears to some of us to be separative and isolating, and to have caused division among those who were formerly together. With what have you identified yourself? Krishnamurti. Now, let us first see the truth of the statement that identification divides. separates. I have stated that several times. Is it a fact or not? What do we mean by identification? Don't just merely and verbally indulge in it, but look at it directly. You identify yourself with your country, don't you? When you do that, what happens? You immediately enclose yourself through that identification with a particular group. That is a fact, is it not? When you call yourself a Hindu, you have identified yourself with particular beliefs, traditions, hopes, ideas, and that very identification isolates you. That is a fact, is it not? If you see the truth of that, then you cease to identify. Therefore, you are no longer a Hindu, or a Buddhist, or a Christian, politically or religiously. So identification is separative. It is a deteriorating factor in life. That is a fact. That is the truth of it, whether you like it or not. The questioner goes on to ask if I have, through my action, brought about division among those who were formerly together. Quite right. If you see something true, must you not state it? Though it brings trouble, though it brings about disunity, should you not state it? How can there be unity on falsity? You identify yourself with an idea, with a belief, and when another questions that belief, the idea, you throw that other fellow out. You don't bring him in. You push him out. You have isolated him. The man who says what you are doing is wrong has not isolated you. So your action is isolating, and not his action, not the action of the person who points to the truth. You don't want to face the fact that identification is separative. Identification with a family, with an idea, with a belief, with any particular organization is all separative. When that is directly put an end to, or when you are made to look at it and are given the challenge, then you who want to identify, who want to be separative, who want to push the other fellow out, say, that man is isolating. Your way of existence, your way of life, is separative, and so you are responsible for separation. I am not. You have thrown me out. I have not gone out. Naturally, you begin to feel that I am isolating, that I am bringing division, that my ideas and my expressions are destroying, are destructive. They should be destructive. They should be revolutionary. Otherwise, what is the value of anything new? Surely, sirs, there must be revolution, not according to any particular ideology or pattern. If it is according to an ideology or pattern, then it is not revolution. It is merely the continuation of the past. It is identification with a new idea, and therefore it gives continuity to a particular form, and that is certainly not revolution. Revolution comes into being when there is an inward cessation of all identification. And you can only do that when you are capable of looking straight at the fact without deceiving yourself and without giving the interpreter a chance to tell you what he thinks of it. Seeing the truth of identification, obviously I am not identified with anything. When I see a truth that something hurts, there is no problem. I leave it alone. I cease to identify there or elsewhere. You realize that the whole process of identification is destructive, separative. Whether this process takes place in religious beliefs or in the political dialectical outlook, it is all separative. When you recognize that, when you see that and are fully aware of it, then obviously you are freed. Therefore, there is no identification with anything. Not to be identified means to stand alone, but not as a noble entity facing the world. This has nothing to do with being together, but you are afraid of disunity. The questioner says, I have brought disunity. Have I? I doubt it. You have discovered for yourself the truth of it. If you are persuaded by me, and therefore identify yourself with me, then you have not done a new thing. You have only exchanged one evil for another. We must break to find out. The real revolution is the inward revolution. It is a revolution that sees things clearly, and that is of love. In that state, you have no identification with anything. Awareness is a process of discovery, which becomes blocked through identification. When we are rightly aware of greed in its complexity, there is no struggle against it, no negative assertion of non-greed, which is only another form of self-assertiveness. And in that awareness, we will find that greed has ceased. Our difficulty lies in that we have built around ourselves conclusions, which we call understanding. These conclusions are hindrances to understanding. If you go into this more deeply, you will see that there must be complete abandonment of all that has been accumulated for the being of understanding and wisdom. To be simple is not a conclusion, an intellectual concept for which you strive. There can be simplicity only when the self, with its accumulation, ceases. It is comparatively easy to renounce family, property, fame, things of the world. That is only a beginning. But it is extremely difficult to put away all knowledge, all conditioned memory. In this freedom, this aloneness, there is experience which is beyond and above all creations of the mind. Do not let us ask whether the mind ever can be free from conditioning, from influence. We shall find this out as we proceed in self-knowledge and understanding. Thought, which is a result, cannot understand the causeless. The ways of accumulation are subtle. Accumulation is self-assertiveness, as is imitation. To come to a conclusion is to build a wall around oneself, a protective security which prevents understanding. Accumulated conclusions do not make for wisdom, but only sustain the self. Without accumulation, there is no self. A mind weighed down with accumulations is incapable of following the swift movement of life, incapable of deep and pliable awareness. Questioner: Being imitative, what shall we do? Krishnamurti: Be self-aware, which will reveal the hidden motives of imitation, envy, fear, the craving for security, for power, and so on. This awareness, when free of self-identification, brings understanding and tranquility, which lead to the realization of supreme wisdom. Q. Is not this process of awareness, of self-unfoldment, another form of acquisition? Is not probing another means of self-expansive acquisitiveness? K. If the questioner experimented with awareness, he would discover the truth about his question. Understanding is never accumulative. Understanding comes only when there is stillness, when there is passive alertness. There is no stillness, no passivity, when the mind is acquisitive. Acquisitiveness is ever restless, envious. As we said, awareness is not cumulative. Through identification, accumulation is built up, giving continuity to the self through memory. To be aware without self-identification, without condemnation or justification, is extremely arduous, for our response is based on pleasure and pain, reward and punishment. How few are aware of constant identification? If we were, we would not ask these questions, which indicate unawareness. As a sleeper dreams that he must awaken but does not, for it is only a dream, so we are asking these questions without actually experimenting with awareness. Q. Is there anything that one can do to be aware? K. Are you not in conflict, in sorrow? If you are, do you not search out its cause? The cause is the self, its torturing desires. To struggle with these desires only creates resistance, further pain. But if you are choicelessly aware of your craving, then there comes creative understanding. It is the truth of this understanding that liberates, not your struggle against resistance to envy, anger, pride, and so on. So awareness is not an act of will, for will is resistance, the effort made by the self through desire to acquire, to grow, whether positively or negatively. Be aware of acquisitiveness, passively observing its ways on different levels. You will find this rather arduous, for thought-feeling sustains itself on identification, and it is this which prevents the understanding of accumulation. Be aware. Take the journey of self-discovery. Do not ask what is going to happen on this journey, which only betrays anxiety, fear, indicating your desire for security, for certainty. This desire for refuge prevents self-knowledge, self-unfoldment, and so understanding. Be aware of this inward anxiety and directly experience it. Then you will discover what this awareness reveals. But unfortunately, most of you only desire to talk about the journey without undertaking it. Q. What happens to us at the end of the journey? K. Is it not important for the questioner to be aware of why he is asking this question? Is it not because of the fear of the unknown, the desire to gain an end, or the assurance of self-continuity? Being in sorrow, we seek happiness. Being impermanent, we search after the permanent. Being in darkness, we look for light. But if we were aware of what is, then the truth of sorrow, of impermanence, of imprisonment, would liberate thought from its own ignorance. Q. Is there no such thing as creative thinking? K. It would be rather vain to consider what is creativeness. If we were aware of our conditioning, then the truth of this would bring about creative being. To speculate upon creative being is a hindrance. All speculation is a hindrance to understanding. Only when the mind is simple, purged of all self-deception and cunning, cleansed of all accumulation, is there the real. The purgation of the mind is not an act of will, nor the outcome of imitative compulsion. Awareness of what is liberating. Awareness is the solution of our problems. We must experiment with it and discover its truth. It would be folly merely to accept. To accept is not to understand. Acceptance or non-acceptance is a positive act, which hinders experimentation and understanding. Understanding that comes through experiment and self-knowledge brings confidence. This confidence may be called faith. It is not the faith of the foolish. It is not faith in something. Ignorance may have faith in wisdom, darkness in light, cruelty in love. But such faith is still ignorance. This confidence or faith of which I am speaking comes through experimentation in self-knowledge, not through acceptance and hope. The self-confidence that many have is the outcome of ignorance, of achievement, of self-glory, or of capacity. The confidence of which I speak is understanding, not the I understand, but understanding without self-identification. The confidence or faith in something, however noble, breeds only obstinacy, and obstinacy is another term for credulity. The clever ones have destroyed blind faith, but when they themselves are in serious conflict or sorrow, they accept faith or become cynical. To believe is not to be religious. To have faith in something, which is created by the mind, is not to be open to the real. Confidence comes into being. It cannot be manufactured by the mind. Confidence comes with experiment and discovery. Not the experiment with belief, theory, or memory, but experimentation with self-knowledge. This confidence or faith is not self-imposed, nor is it identified with belief, formulation, hope. It is not the outcome of self-expanding desire. In experimenting with awareness, there is a discovery which is freeing in its understanding. This self-knowledge through passive awareness is from moment to moment, without accumulation. It is endless, truly creative. Through awareness, there comes vulnerability to truth. To be open, vulnerable to the real, thought must cease to be accumulative. It is not that thought-feeling must become non-greedy, which is still accumulative, a negative form of self-expansion, but it must be non-greedy. A greedy mind is a conflicting mind. A greedy mind is ever fearful, envious in its self-growth and fulfillment. Such a mind is ever changing the objects of its desire, and this changing is considered growth. A greedy mind which renounces the world in order to seek reality, God, is still greedy. Greed is ever restless, ever seeking growth, fulfillment, and this restless activity creates self-assertive intelligence, but is not capable of understanding the real. Greed is a complex problem. To live in the world of greed without greed needs deep understanding. To live simply, earning a right livelihood in a world organized on economic aggression and expansion, is possible only for those who are discovering inward riches. Questioner: Is there a technique for being aware? Krishnamurti: What does this question imply? You seek a method by which you may learn to be aware. Awareness is not the result of practice, habit, or time. As a tooth that causes intense pain has to be attended to immediately, so sorrow, if intense, demands urgent alleviation. But instead, we seek an escape, or explain it away. We avoid the real issue, which is the self. Because we are not facing our conflict, our sorrow, we assure ourselves lazily that we must make an effort to be aware. And so we demand a technique for becoming aware. The observer and the observed are one. The thinker and his thoughts are one. To experience the thinker and his thought as one is very arduous, for the thinker is ever taking shelter behind his thought. He separates himself from his thoughts to safeguard himself, to give himself continuity, permanency. He modifies or changes his thoughts, but he remains. This pursuit of thought apart from himself, this changing, transforming it, leads to illusion. The thinker is his thought. The thinker and his thoughts are not two separate processes. We generally regard our thoughts as being apart from ourselves. We are not aware of the thinker and his thought as one. This is precisely the difficulty. After all, the qualities of the self are not separate from the self. The self is not something apart from its thoughts, from its attributes. The self is put together, made up, and the self is not when the parts are dissolved. But in illusion, the self separates itself from its qualities in order to protect itself, to give itself continuity, permanency. It takes refuge in its qualities through separating itself from them. The self asserts that it is this and it is that. The self, the I, modifies, changes, transforms its thoughts, its qualities, but this change only gives strength to the self, to its protective walls. But if you are aware deeply, you will perceive that the thinker and his thoughts are one. The observer is the observed. To experience this actual integrated fact is extremely difficult, and right meditation is the way to this integration. The additive process prevents the experiencing of the real. Where there is accumulation, there is a becoming of the self, which is the cause of conflict and pain. The accumulative desire for pleasure and the avoidance of pain is a becoming. Awareness is non-accumulative, for it is ever discovering truth, and truth can only be when there is no accumulation, when there is no imitation. Awareness is observation without condemnation. Awareness brings understanding, because there is no condemnation or identification, but silent observation. Surely, if I want to understand something, I must observe. I must not criticize. I must not condemn. I must not pursue it as pleasure or avoid it as non-pleasure. There must merely be the silent observation of a fact. There is no end in view, but awareness of everything as it arises. That observation and the understanding of that observation cease when there is condemnation, identification, or justification. Awareness is not self-improvement. On the contrary, it is the ending of the self, of the I, with all its peculiar idiosyncrasies, memories, demands, and pursuits. In awareness, there is no condemnation or identification. Therefore, there is no self-improvement. There is a vast difference between the two. The man who wants to improve himself can never be aware, because improvement implies condemnation and the achievement of a result. Whereas, in awareness, there is observation without condemnation, without denial, or acceptance. That awareness begins with outward things, being aware, being in contact with objects, with nature. First, there is awareness of things about one, being sensitive to objects, to nature, then to people, which means relationship. And then there is awareness of ideas. This awareness, being sensitive to things, to nature, to people, to ideas, is not made up of separate processes, but is one unitary process. It is a constant observation of everything, of every thought and feeling and action, as they arise within oneself. And as awareness is not condemnatory, there is no accumulation. You condemn only when you have a standard, which means there is accumulation, and therefore improvement of the self. Awareness is to understand the activities of the self, the I, in its relationship with people, with ideas, and with things. That awareness is from moment to moment, and therefore it cannot be practiced. When you practice a thing, it becomes a habit, and awareness is not habit. A mind that is habitual is insensitive. A mind that is functioning within the groove of a particular action is dull, unpliable. Whereas Awareness demands constant pliability, alertness. This is not difficult. It is what you all do when you are interested in something, when you are interested in watching your child, your wife, your plants, trees, birds. You observe without condemnation, without identification. Therefore, in that observation, there is complete communion. The observer and the observed are completely in communion. This actually takes place when you are deeply, profoundly interested in something. Awareness is a process of release from the action of the self. It is to be aware of your daily movements, of your thoughts, of your actions, and to be aware of another, to observe him. You can do that only when you love somebody, when you are deeply interested in something. And when I want to know myself, my whole being, the whole content of myself, and not just one or two layers, then there obviously must be no condemnation. Then I must be open to every thought, to every feeling, to all the moods, to all the suppressions. And as there is more and more expansive awareness, there is greater and greater freedom from all the hidden movement of thoughts, motives, and pursuits. So awareness is freedom. It brings freedom. It yields freedom. Now, when you have a profound experience of any kind, what is taking place? When there is such an experience, are you aware that you are experiencing? When you are angry, at the split second of anger, or of jealousy, or of joy, are you aware that you are joyous or that you are angry? It is only when the experience is over that there is the experiencer and the experienced. Then the experiencer observes the experienced, the object of experience. But at the moment of experience, there is neither the observer nor the observed. There is only the experiencing. Now, most of us are not experiencing. We are always outside the state of experiencing. And therefore, we ask this question as to who is the observer? Who is it that is aware? Surely, such a question is a wrong question, is it not? The moment there is experiencing, there is neither the person who is aware nor the object of which he is aware. There is neither the observer nor the observed, but only a state of experiencing. Most of us find it extremely difficult to live in a state of experiencing, because that demands an extraordinary pliability, a quickness, a high degree of sensitivity. And that is denied when we are pursuing a result, when we want to succeed, when we have an end in view, when we are calculating, all of which brings frustration. But a man who does not demand anything, who is not seeking an end, who is not searching out a result with all its implications, such a man is in a state of constant experiencing. Everything then has a movement, a meaning, and nothing is old, nothing is charred, nothing is repetitive, because what is never old. The challenge is always new. It is only the response to the challenge that is old, and the old creates further residue, which is memory, the observer who separates himself from the observed, from the challenge, from the experience. You can experiment with this for yourself very simply and very easily. Next time you are angry or jealous or greedy or violent or whatever it be, watch yourself. In that state, you are not. There is only that state of being. But the moment, the second afterwards, you term it, you name it, you call it jealousy, anger, greed. So you have created immediately the observer and the observed, the experiencer and the experienced. When there is the experiencer and the experienced, Then the experiencer tries to modify the experience, change it, remember things about it, and so on, and therefore maintains the division between himself and the experienced. But if you don't name that feeling, which means you are not seeking a result, you are not condemning, you are merely silently aware of the feeling, then you will see that in that state of feeling, of experiencing, there is no observer and no observed, because the observer and the observed are a joint phenomenon, and there is only experiencing. Awareness is a state in which there is no condemnation, no justification or identification, and therefore there is understanding. And in that state of passive, alert awareness, there is neither the experiencer nor the experienced. Sir, what I am saying is not very difficult, though you may find it verbally difficult. But you will notice when you yourself are interested in something very gravely and very deeply, this actually takes place. You are so completely submerged in the thing in which you are interested that there is no exclusion, no concentration. Awareness is a state in which truth can come into being, the truth of what is, the simple truth of daily existence. It is only when we understand the truth of daily existence that we can go far. You must begin near to go far, but most of us want to jump, to begin far, without understanding what is close. As we understand the near, we will find the distance between the near and the far is not. There is no distance. The beginning and the end are one. Questioner, I have listened to what you have been saying, and I feel that to carry out your teachings, I must renounce the world I live in.
Krishnamurti, sir, you cannot renounce the world, can you? What is the world? The world is made up of things, relationships, and ideas. How can you give up things? Even if you give up your house, you will still have a kurta, clothing. You may renounce your wife, but you will still be in relation with someone, with the milkman, for instance, or the man who gives you food. And you cannot renounce belief, can you? I wish you would. Begin there, if you must renounce something. Renounce the wrong valuations which you have given to everything. Wrong valuations create havoc, and it is from these wrong valuations, which cause misery, that you want to escape. You don't want to understand that you are giving wrong values. You want to escape from the result of wrong values. But if you understood the world, which is ideas, relationship, things, and their true significance, then you would not be in conflict with the world. You cannot withdraw from the world. To withdraw means isolation, and you cannot live in isolation. You can live in isolation only in an asylum, but not by renouncing the world. You can only live truly happily with the world when you are not of the world, which means you don't give wrong values to the things in the world. This can happen only when you understand yourself, the giver of wrong values. It is like a stupid man trying to renounce stupidity. He will still be stupid. He may try to become clever, but he will remain stupid. But if he understood what stupidity is, that is, himself, surely then he would reach great heights. Then he would have wisdom. It is not by renouncing that you can find reality. By renouncing, you escape into illusion. You do not discover that which is true. So what I have been saying is that one must give right values to things, to relationship, to ideas, and not try to escape from the world. It is comparatively easy to go away into isolation, but it is extremely arduous to be aware and to give true values.
Things have no value in themselves. The house has no value in itself, but it has the value you give it. If psychologically you are empty, insufficient in yourself, the house becomes very important because you identify yourself with the house. And then comes the problem of attachment and renunciation. It is really stupid. And if you understood your inward nature, your inward hollowness, then the problem would have very little meaning. Everything becomes extraordinarily significant when you are trying to use it to cover up your own loneliness. Similarly, with relationship, with ideas, with belief. So there is richness only in understanding the significance of what is, and not in running away into isolation. It does not matter what any book says. Is the thinker separate from his thought? If he is separate, problems will continue. If he is not, then he can be freed of the source of all problems. If the thinker is separate from his thoughts, how does he become separated? Remove the qualities of the thinker. Remove his thoughts. Where is the thinker? The thinker is not. Remove the qualities of the self, which is memory, ambition, and so on. Where is the self? But if you say the self is not the thinker, but some other entity behind the thinker, he is still the thinker, because you have only pushed the thinker further back. Now, why has the thinker separated himself from his thoughts? The thinker cannot be without thought, because if there is no thought, there is no thinker. Now, the thinker has separated himself from the thought for the simple reason that thought can be transformed, can be modified. And so, in order to give himself permanency, the thinker separates himself from the thought and thereby gives himself permanency. The thought, being transient, mutable, can be altered, but the thinker who creates the thought can be permanent. He is the permanent entity, whereas the thought is changeable. It can be changed according to circumstances, according to environmental influences. But he, the thinker, remains. He is the thought, and if thought ceases, he is not, surely, although all our books say differently. Just think it out for yourself for the first time. Put your books aside, forget your authorities, and look at the problem directly. Without the thought, the thinker is not. And the thinker creates the thought and separates himself from it in order to protect himself. Thereby, he gives stability, certainty to himself, and continuity. Now, how does the thinker come into being? Obviously, through desire. Desire is the outcome of perception, contact, sensation, identification, and me. Perception of a car, contact, sensation, desire, identification, and I like it, I want it. So, I am the product. The thinker is the product of desire. And having produced the I separates itself from the thought, because it can then transform the thought and yet remain permanent. So as long as the thinker is separate from his thought, there will be problems, one after the other, innumerable problems. But if there is no separation, if the thinker is the thought, then what happens? Then the thinker himself undergoes a transformation, a radical, fundamental transformation. And that, as I have said, is meditation. It is self-knowledge. It is all that I have said about the thinker, how he separates himself from the thought, and how the thinker has come into being. You can test it for yourself. You don't have to read a sacred book to find out the truth of it. That is the beginning of self-knowledge. And from that, there comes meditation. Meditation is the ending of thought, of the thinker, by not giving significance to the thinker, by not giving continuity to the thinker. The thinker is disciplining his thought, separating himself so as to give continuity to himself through property, through family, through ideas. And as long as the thinker exists, there will be problems. And it is when the thinker ceases thinking that meditation begins. Meditation is self-knowledge, and without self-knowledge, there is no meditation. You will find that if you go into the whole question of self-knowledge, which is the beginning of wisdom, not by any practice, because practice is merely resistance, you can go deeper and deeper, starting with the center, which is the desire creating the I, the self. And when that self continues in the Atman or higher self, it is still the thinker merely pushing further back his permanency. Till you are aware of this whole process, there is no ending of the problem. But when you become aware, you will find that time has ceased, time as memory of the past and the future, and that there is the immediate present, the eternal, and in this alone is reality.
In the various talks the speaker has given, he has used the word insight, that is, to see into things, into the whole movement of thought, into the whole movement, for example, of jealousy, to perceive the nature of greed, to see the whole content of sorrow. It is not analysis, not exercise of intellectual capacity, nor is it the result of knowledge, knowledge being that which has been accumulated through the past as experience, stored up in the brain. Knowledge always goes with ignorance. There is no complete knowledge. Therefore, there is always knowledge and ignorance, like two horses tethered. So then, what is insight? If observation is not based on knowledge or on intellectual capacity of reasoning, exploring, analyzing, then what is it? That is the whole question. Is it intuition? That word intuition is rather a tricky word. The actuality of intuition may be the result of desire. One may desire something, and then a few days later, you have an intuition about it, and you think that intuition is most extraordinarily important. But if you go into it rather deeply, you may find that it is based on desire, on fear, on various forms of pleasure. So one is rather doubtful about that word, especially as it is used by those people who are rather romantic, who are rather imaginative, sentimental, and wanting something. They would certainly have intuitions, but these may be based on some obvious self-deceptive desire. So, for the moment, we can put aside the word intuition. I hope I am not hurting anybody who is caught in intuitions. And if that is not so, then what is insight? That is, to perceive something instantly which must be true, logical, sane, rational. You understand? And that insight must act instantly. It isn't that I have an insight and do nothing about it. I will explain a little bit about thinking. Thinking is the response of memory. Memory is the residue of experience, knowledge, stored up in the brain. And the memory responds. Where do you live? You answer. What is your name? There is immediate response, and so on. Thought is the result or the response of accumulated experience, knowledge as memory. That is simple. Thought, based upon knowledge, is limited because knowledge is limited. So thought can never be all-inclusive. It must always be partial, limited, based on knowledge and ignorance. Therefore, it is everlastingly confined, narrow. Now, to have an insight into that means an action that is not merely the repetition of thought. To have an insight means that you are observing without memory,
remembrances, without argumentation, pro and con, just seeing the whole movement. And from that insight, you act. And that action is logical, is sane, healthy. It is not that you have an insight, and then you do the opposite. Then it is not insight. I wonder if you are getting all this. Sorry to be so emphatic. That is my way of doing it. To have an insight, for example, into the wounds, hurts that one has received from childhood. We are all people who are hurt for various reasons. From childhood until we die, there is this wound in us, psychologically. Can you have an insight into the whole nature and structure of that hurt? Do you understand? Aren't you hurt, wounded psychologically? Play the game with me. The ball is in your court. You are obviously hurt. You may go to a psychologist, analyst, psychotherapist, and they trace why you are hurt. From childhood, your mother was this, and your father was that, and so on, and so on. But merely seeking out the cause is not going to resolve the hurt. It is there. And the consequences of that are isolation, fear, resistance, and the self-enclosure of not wanting to be hurt anymore. You know all this. That's the whole movement of being hurt. The hurt is the image that you have created for yourself about yourself, right? So long as that image remains, you will be hurt, obviously. When there is an insight into all that, without analysis, seeing it instantly, by the very perception of that insight, which demands all your attention and energy, the hurt is dissolved. And therefore, when it is dissolved, there is no further hurt. If one may ask most politely, you have heard this, have you got that insight that will dissolve your hurt completely, leaving no mark and therefore no hurt, so that nobody can hurt you? Because the image that you have created about yourself is non-existent. Are you following all this? Are you doing it? Or are you just merely verbally paying attention to the words? Questioner, I don't really understand what you mean when you say we have created this hurt. Krishnamurti, first of all, who is hurt? What do you mean by being hurt? Sir, what do you mean by being hurt? You say, I am hurt. Consciously, you are aware of it or not. One is hurt. Now, what is that which is being hurt? Do you understand my question? What is that which is hurt? You say, it is me. What is that me? It is the image you have about yourself. If I have an image about myself, I am marvelous, spiritual, blah, blah, and you come along and say, no, you are a silly ass, I get hurt. That is, thought has created an image about oneself, and that image is always comparing. So as long as one has this image about oneself, it is going to be trodden on by somebody, and that causes hurt, wounds, psychologically. To have an insight into that means to see the whole movement, the cause and the image, and therefore the very perception ends the image. When a machine is revolving very fast, as a fan with several blades, the separate parts are not visible, but appear as one. So the self, the me, seems to be a unified entity. But if its activities can be slowed down, then we shall perceive that it is not a unified entity, but made up of many separate and contending desires and pursuits. These separate wants and hopes, fears and joys, make up the self. The self is a term to cover craving in its different forms. To understand the self, there must be an awareness of craving in its multiple aspects. The passive awareness, the choiceless discernment, reveals the ways of the self, bringing freedom from bondage. Thus, when the mind is tranquil and free of its own activity and chatter, there is supreme wisdom. Our problem, then, is how to free thought from its accumulated experiences, memories. How can this self cease to be? Deep and true experience takes place only when the activity of this accumulation ceases. We see that unless there is an experience of truth, none of our problems can be solved, whether sociological, religious, or personal. Conflict cannot come to an end by merely rearranging frontiers or reorganizing economic values or imposing a new ideology. Throughout the centuries, we have tried these many ways, but conflict and sorrow have continued. Until there is a comprehension of the real, merely pruning the branches of our self-expansive activity is of little use, for the central problem remains unsolved. Until we discover truth, there is no way out of our sorrows and problems. The solution is the direct experience of truth when the mind is still, in the tranquility of awareness, in the openness of receptivity. We often have religious experiences, sometimes vague, sometimes definite, experiences of intense devotion or joy, of being deeply vulnerable, of fleeting unity with all things. We try to utilize these experiences in meeting our difficulties and sorrows. These experiences are numerous, but our thought, caught in time, turmoil, and pain, tries to use them as stimulants to overcome our conflicts. We say God or truth will help us in our difficulties, but these experiences do not actually resolve our sorrow and confusion. Such moments of deep experience come when thought is not active in its self-protective memories. These experiences are independent of our striving, and when we try to use them as stimulants for strength in our struggles, they only further the expansion of the self and its peculiar intelligence. So we come back to our question, how can this intelligence of the self, so sedulously cultivated, cease? It can cease only through passive awareness. Awareness is from moment to moment. It is not the cumulative effect of self-protective memories. Awareness is not determination, nor is it the action of will. Awareness is without rationalization, without the division of the observer and the observed. As awareness is non-accumulative, non-residual, it does not build up the self, positively or negatively. Awareness is ever in the present, and so non-identifying and non-repetitive, nor does it create habit. Take, for instance, the habit of smoking and experiment with it in awareness. Be aware of smoking. Do not condemn, rationalize, or accept. Simply be aware. If you are so aware, there is the cessation of the habit. If you are so aware, there will be no recurrence of it. But if you are not aware, the habit will persist. This awareness is not the determination to cease or to indulge. Be aware. There is a fundamental difference between being and becoming. To become aware, you make effort, and effort implies resistance and time and leads to conflict. If you are aware in the moment, there is no effort, no continuance of the self-protective intelligence. You are aware or you are not. The desire to be aware is only the activity of the sleeper, the dreamer. Awareness reveals the problem completely, fully, without denial or acceptance, justification or identification, and it is freedom which quickens understanding. Awareness is a unitary process of the observer and the observed. It is the petty mind that creates problems for itself, and through awareness of the cause of problems, the self, they are dissolved. To be aware of narrowness and its many results implies deep understanding of it on all the different levels of consciousness. Pettiness in things, in relationship, in ideas. When we are conscious of being petty or violent or envious, we make an effort not to be. We condemn it, for we desire to be something else. This condemnatory attitude puts an end to the understanding of what is and its process. The desire to put an end to greed is another form of self-assertion, and so is the cause of continued conflict and pain. Through awareness, only can there be cessation of the cause of conflict. Be aware of any habit of thought or action. Then you will recognize the rationalizing, condemnatory process which is preventing understanding. Through awareness, the reading of the book of habit, page by page, comes self-knowledge. It is truth that frees, not your effort to be free.